From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The New York Post offers an apology, sort of, for a cartoon that has sparked protests and boycotts. And President Barack Obama tells mayors from across the country that economic help is on the way. He meets with the nation's governors next. But how much can the stimulus package help state and local governments? And he's been president for 1 month. We'll look at how Barack Obama has fared so far. For the week's top stories, we turn now to our Reporters Roundtable, and we begin with Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Welcome, Jerome.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. We'll get to the new president's report card in just a moment, but this story has been front and center. After 2 days of protest, the New York Post has given a qualified apology for a cartoon it published this week. The controversial drawing showed two cops shooting a chimpanzee, which many interpreted as representing President Obama and conjuring racist images of African Americans. Now, the Post said the cartoon was, quote, meant to mock an ineptly written federal stimulus bill, period. But it has been taken as something else, as a depiction of President Obama as a thinly veiled expression of racism. This most certainly was not its intent, end quote. The paper went on to say, again in quotes, there are some in the media and in public life who have had differences with the Post in the past, and they see the incident as an opportunity for payback. And the paper ended the quote with this: to them, no apology is due. So, Jerome, was an apology due, qualified or otherwise, and is this response sufficient, do you think?
I think absolutely. I mean, doesn't matter what your intent is, if you have offended a large number of people, which obviously this cartoon did, then probably you need to issue an apology. You've touched some nerve. You've rubbed some people the wrong way with this. Doesn't make sense not to apologize for an incident like this.
We have Corey Day joining us now, the Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Hello, Corey.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You're a newspaper guy. What about this? Is an apology in order? Was it, and was this a sufficient apology?
Well, I don't think it should surprise many people that the New York Post is being provocative. I think they have set that record for, they've had that record for quite a while. I think at this point, an apology is fairly empty because of their track record. But at the same time, I don't know that the offended party here, the president, really cares. I think this is just part and parcel.
Let's listen to an exchange between Ron Christie, who is African-American and a former aide to then-President George W. Bush, and CNN's David Gergen that took place on CNN's AC360 two nights ago.
I also read the comments of the cartoonist who said that was not his intent. Let's give people the benefit of the doubt as opposed to always finding racial problems in every situation.
But Ron, do you agree that a lot of people would look at that and say, chimpanzee, baboon, Obama, they're trying to link all those together? Do you not think it's open to that interpretation?
I should point out that Christie is also a contributor on this program. What about his argument, Jerome?
Well, I think people are a little more sensitive about racial issues now that the president is not a white male. I know, for example, we've been getting a number of calls here in our newsroom over the past several weeks. People, upset that we in the media call him Mr. Obama as opposed to President Obama on every reference. And so we've gotten a lot of calls about that. And we've had to say, it was Mr. Bush, it was Mr. Carter, it was Mr. Clinton. It's a sign of honor. And so I think people are very tender right now. They want to make sure that President Obama is being treated with the respect he is due, and if they feel that's not the case, they are going to speak up about it.
Well, Corey Dade, speaking about race, another controversy was triggered this week when Attorney General Eric Holder said America is, quote, essentially a nation of cowards, end quote, when it comes to talking about race. Now, these comments ignited ire from conservatives. Is the criticism justified in this case? I mean, did he go too far, or is he just speaking the truth?
Well, I think that any African American would probably have a similar response. So I guess that doesn't surprise me. What does surprise me is that he did say it. Eric Holder has a long reputation for being cool under fire, for being buttoned down, for being, you know, always on guard with what he says publicly. He's an attorney, of course, so that factors into it also. And I was also surprised that he made these comments now that he has just taken office and he's talking to his employees. So I think on the content of what he said doesn't surprise me. I think the circumstances were more surprising than anything else.
Well, you know, Jerome, the point that Corey made was one I was going to present to you about the timing of this and what message Holder is sending. Is the message that the Department of Justice is going to get tough again on enforcing civil rights laws related to race?
I think it's too early to tell. To me, he's a great politician. But as Corey said, you know, there's something visceral about that reaction. And, you know, it could be that a little bit of that slipped out. Maybe they are sending a little bit of a signal. But I think in reality, it's too early to tell. I mean, he's been in there a few weeks.
Well, Jerome, one more thing about this. Does the controversy in both these instances, the Post cartoon and the Attorney General, does that belie the post-racial atmosphere that we've been hearing so much about?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I mean, in my opinion, I don't think there's a post-racial atmosphere. I mean, I think people still have the same issues they did before President Obama took office, the same issues they had before he was nominated, before he decided to run. Has the needle moved? Yes. But I think there are still a lot of those issues out there to be discussed and worked out. So that's where I would leave it.
All right. This week, let's move on to another topic, because this week President Obama signed a stimulus package, unveiled a housing rescue plan, and made his first trip as president outside the United States. Let's talk stimulus first. Mr. Obama meeting with the mayors just today, hosting the nation's governors at the White House over the weekend. Now, many GOP governors are ideologically opposed to the spending plan, and Louisiana's Governor Bobby Jindal says he is not sure if his state will accept the federal money. So my question, Corey, to you, other Republicans, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Charlie Crist, to name two, are going to take the money. Can any governor really afford to say no when their states are hurting so badly?
No, they can't. And Bobby Jindal, of all governors, given his brilliance, given his fiscal acuity, and given how he's run the state since being elected, you know, they're not going to take this lightly. At this point, this is politics. The Republican Party overall has decided to draw a line in the sand and take a hard line against the stimulus package. And what's noticeable is the two things, that the governors who are doing this obviously are Republican, but they're in the South, mostly with the exception of Palin, of course. But also, these are governors who have very strong approval ratings, who can really afford to challenge the president right now. But when the rubber meets the road, we will see all, if not most of them, take not only all of the money, but probably make sure they can, you know, more when the time comes for the next economic spending bill.
One of the things that was interesting, Jerome, was when the mayors exited from the White House today after meeting with the president, both Republican and Democratic mayors were hopeful of getting this money, and it gave me the impression that there will be some pushback from them in terms of their expectations coming out of Congress, and that it not be bottled up by some bipartisan bickering. And to that point, what about the $75 billion housing rescue plan, for example? Do you think this will be an easier sell along a bipartisan Congress than the stimulus was?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, the Republicans have seen that they had some small victory in this first battle. I think they're going to dig their heels in. I think they're going to try to get some more traction until they see that there's pushback on this, until they see that their constituents are saying, hey, we would like some more bipartisanship. I think they're going to continue to push in that direction and see how this next administration with President Obama, how far they're willing to go and where they're going to take it.
Yesterday, the president traveled north to Canada, arguably America's most important trading partner, but NAFTA and the Buy American provision of the stimulus package threatened to undermine his first, in quotes, foreign visit. How well did he allay their fears, Corey?
Well, I think he's going to – I think he did – he went to the lengths that he needed to go to for the moment. I think what you're seeing in this president is a fair amount of judiciousness with what he does. And so I think there was a careful calibration there that he needed to assure the Canadian government and businesses in Canada and elsewhere in North America of what his intentions were as it relates to NAFTA and trade in this hemisphere. But at the same time, I think there's a recognition on the part of his administration that this isn't going to go away easily, that the problems with NAFTA, the problems with trade imbalances, et cetera, are things that he's going to have to revisit.
All right, there's a lot more that we want to get to for this week's Reporters Roundtable. We have we want to talk about Governor Sebelius out of Kansas, and of course we want to talk about Roland Burris and what's happening with him, as well as the First Lady Michelle Obama hosting some children at the White House. But I'm going to ask you guys to just sit tight. We're going to take a quick break, and we will continue this conversation in just a few moments. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back with our Reporters Roundtable. With us today, Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan, and Corey Dade, the Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Let's jump back into it, guys. State governments are really struggling, as we know. California finally passed a budget just this week amid a $42 billion deficit. Kansas, another state having the same problems. And now Democratic Governor Kathleen Sebelius might be tapped to be the next Health and Human Services Secretary. So my question, Corey, I'll come to you first. Will the Dems get it right this time?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. I think, as we probably remember, the governor was rumored and speculated on to be in the running to be vice presidential running mate for Obama. But even beyond that, she was pivotal in delivering the state to Obama. Obviously, Obama has familial ties to Kansas. Beyond that, though, the governor has always struck Obama and his advisors as very steady, very calm under fire, very sort of measured, and in general, a very good administrator. And so, and she has the chops as far as her government experience is concerned. I think that what will be interesting is on the vetting issue, and I think that at this point the administration doesn't want to take any chances, especially with a candidate in the governor who is actually a strong candidate who is very well liked within the party and the administration. I think that what's interesting here is that, you know, she's probably already been fairly vetted already just by virtue of her being in sort of the VP running mate realm. The Obama campaign and the transition office had the strictest sort of vetting and backgrounding checks that anyone had ever seen in a transition office. So,
but, you know, you could argue that that vetting wasn't as effective as it could have been. There were at least a couple of instances that we know of where that didn't work out the way the Obama team intended. And now, although this isn't at the feet of the Obama camp, but the Roland Burris debacle in Illinois is certainly another potential black eye for the Democratic Party if they don't get it right. And now people are asking for Burris to step down. As a matter of fact, Jerome, he revealed this week that he did try to fundraise for former Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich after intimating that he had not done so. What options does he have now?
You mean Senator Burris? What options does he have?
What options does he have?
Well, you know, I mean, he can go with the Blagojevich game plan and stay there until someone throws him out of office, or, you know, he can step down and resign. I think really think he's going to stay as long as he can. It worked for Blagojevich for a long while, and maybe he hopes that once again things will turn his favor. When his initial acceptance to the Senate was blocked, he hung in there, he didn't give up, and he was eventually appointed. We're back at this issue again, and so that would be my guess, that he's going to stick it out until something really happens. He's got nothing to lose at this point. He's not going to win a race for Senate during an election. He's not going to be picked for some other office. He's got little to lose.
Well, one of the things that was said about him, we'll end the reporters' roundtable on this topic today, and I'll come to you, Corey, was the initial concern was that he would be tainted because of his connection to Blagojevich. He managed to get through the impeachment situation with Blagojevich. He managed to get seated in the United States Senate, and now that taint is as strong as ever.
Right. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't, in a way. I think that he was going to be damaged goods regardless. It certainly is not the candidate that the party, the state party in Illinois, or the national party wanted, wanted in that role, in that seat. And I think that they just held their nose, and even the Obama administration knew that it would be bad form if they opposed him, A, because he's from Illinois, he's replacing his seat, B, because he's with the Democrats, and maybe perhaps to a lesser degree because he's African American. But I think at this point, you know, I think that the expectations for him are so low that he can't really underachieve. I think that no one from constituents in Illinois to the Democratic Party is expecting him to amount to anything other than sort of just keeping the seat warm for the next candidate.
All right. Well, gentlemen, unfortunately, our time has run out. We don't have the time to get to the Michelle Obama story. We'll have to save that for another time. Jerome Vaughn, thank you very much. Corey Day, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Jerome Vaughn is the news program director for WDET in Detroit. He joined us from the studios there. And Corey Day is the Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us by phone. Much of President Obama's policy agenda revolves around the three E's: environment, energy, and the economy. Obama made many campaign promises about green-collar jobs and alternative fuels, and now, with many environmentally generous handouts in the stimulus package, he may have put his money where his mouth is. Today, we continue our series on the Obama effect with a look at how green goals could compete with economic concerns. And for more on this, we have David Roberts, staff writer for environmental news website grist.org, Leslie Fields, the National Environmental Justice and Community Partnerships Director for the Sierra Club, and Jerome Ringo, the president of the Apollo Alliance, a coalition of labor, business, and environmental activists who are working towards clean energy solutions. David, Leslie, Jerome, welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, Tony.
Thank you.
David, I'm going to come to you first. Most of the environmental provisions that President Obama put into the stimulus package have passed. Did he, in fact, put his money where his mouth is? And can you break down for us the parts of the stimulus plan that will be good for both the economy and the environment?
I think he largely did. Some of it got trimmed back a little bit in Congress, especially in the Senate, and then some got restored in committee. I think the big and most obvious win in the stimulus package are these investments in retrofitting buildings, particularly federal buildings, for energy efficiency. Because, you know, you use the word handout in the intro, but I think the better way to view these things is as investments. You invest in retrofitting a building, you make it more energy efficient, and you save on energy bills every year from then on. So that's not just a one-time stimulus. You can look at that as a yearly stimulus. Every bit of energy bill you save, you spend elsewhere in the economy. So that's going to be ongoing savings. And then the other big item is, and this was actually Obama's pet issue, Rahm Emanuel, I think, stepped in at the conference committee stage of things and restored this, was a big chunk of money for rail transit. And this is a big ticket item for environmentalists because, you know, it's a huge help in reducing automobile pollution and emissions.
Leslie, are you encouraged, discouraged? How do you feel about what you have seen so far?
Well, thank you for having me on, and I'm very encouraged because the president has created a stimulus package that will really help jumpstart communities, particularly communities of color and low-income communities, in this package for including about $5 billion for low-income weatherization programs, $6 billion in grants to state and local governments. It was mentioned that modernization of federal buildings was included, with a particular emphasis on energy efficiency. And I appreciate the reframing of saying that this isn't a handout. This benefits all Americans. This isn't just a environmentalist special package. This is for all Americans, for the whole economy, and to move us in the right direction. So it's very exciting. And there's other legislation hopefully we'll see soon, but we are very much encouraged.
Jerome, you spent more than 20 years in Louisiana's petrochemical industry. I'd like to ask you the same question. I want to frame it this way, though. Do you think that a lot of the environmental policies are really workable, or are they just ways to satisfy certain segments? And what's your reaction to the stimulus package?
Well, I think the stimulus package is a win-win-win-win for America. It gives us an opportunity to invest in America, not just in weatherization and efficiency, which are critically important, but also it gives us an opportunity to invest in alternative energy and alternative energy technologies, whether it be refitting our assembly lines to build hybrid cars or to advance where we are with respect to alternative energy. But it also helps us to curb the impacts of climate change by promoting alternative energy, which to the atmosphere, and as well helps us reduce our dependency on foreign oil. So it's a win-win. But the most important thing, it creates those green jobs that are going to stimulate.
I think we lost him. Let me come back to you, David, while we try to reconnect with Jerome. I want to talk about the balance between energy and the economy and the environment, because in the spending, in the stimulus package, one of the issues was the balance between spending versus tax cuts. And Jerome was making reference to what he said was he thought an appropriate balance of the three. Do you share that there is an appropriate balance so far going forward?
Yes, I think in the stimulus, I mean, the big consideration for the stimulus bill is that a lot of money gets put into the economy quickly. So that consideration sort of dominated other considerations. I think Leslie is right that there will be other big pieces of legislation and regulation coming up that will be more explicitly focused on the environment. But I want to step back real quickly and just say I know it's a common sentiment that money you spend on clean energy or the environment is expensive and hurts the economy, but I don't think that Obama and the Obama administration accept that premise. I think they view investments in clean energy as an economic boon. I think they view it as a way to revive the economy, and I think that's how they'll approach it.
I think Jerome is back with us. Do you share that view, Jerome, that he just described?
Yes, and I believe that investment in clean energy is critically important, especially at a time when we are seeing unprecedented numbers in job losses across the country. We need to put Americans back to work again, and we have an opportunity by retooling, by retrofitting, by weatherizing, and by making sure, as Leslie said, that those jobs reach all communities across America, especially disadvantaged communities and those communities that in the past have been somewhat disproportionately impacted by poor environmental practices. So it's a win-win.
Well, Leslie, let's talk about that for a moment, because there's clean energy, isn't there, and there's cheap energy as well. And cheaper energy, tell me if you share this view or not, can be environmentally hazardous.
Well, that's correct. And much of the cost of cheaper energy is externalized. So the health costs of people who are in the communities living nearest to most polluting facilities is really not taken into account when their asthma rates for their children have skyrocketed, respiratory problems have skyrocketed, and just general overall poor health and other diseases that are attributed to living next to polluting facilities or nearby or working in these facilities. So many of these costs have been externalized, so we don't count them in, but we all end up paying in terms of the health care costs and other costs associated with, for example, if your child has an asthma attack and is sick and you have to stay home from work, those are job-related costs when parents have to stay home with sick children due to the some type of environmental problem or a, you know, not a, there's a ozone alert that day or something like that. So there are all kinds of costs, and now we're trying to, Jerome is absolutely right, it's very exciting because we're creating new economic opportunities at the same time as we are dealing with cleaning up the environment and also climate change.
Let's talk, David, about some of these green jobs and urban restoration projects and how they are going to, on a dual track, if they are effective, clean up the air and put people back to work and give a boost to the economy at the same time.
Yes, I think that's right. And think about it this way: every dollar we spend on oil, that dollar goes out of the country and basically pays, you know, what economists call scarcity rents to people overseas who are sitting on top of the oil. If we instead invest in using less oil or using less fossil fuels, those dollars go to manufacturing the equipment that helps us do that. Those dollars go to jobs, which are retrofitting and weatherizing and installing solar panels. And then at the end of the process, you get energy savings on a year-to-year basis. So like Jerome said, it's a win-win. And in the process, especially if you craft the policy right, you can create a new class of jobs that are a bridge to the middle class, and a lot of those kind of jobs have been lost from the American economy. There's this growing gap between, you know, low-income communities, communities of color, and the middle class. There used to be a lot more ways to get from one to the other, and this is a class of skilled jobs with a clear career ladder. You know, you start out maybe just drilling in the solar panels, then you move up, you manage a solar panel installation company. There's a clear road upwards. So these are the kind of jobs that our economy has needed for a long time. And the fact that you also get, you know, environmental benefits out of them, you also get economic stimulus benefits out of them, I think is just is a bonus in a way.
Our time has run really, really short, but I'd like to ask you, Jerome, very briefly, if you could, are there petrochemical jobs in this paradigm that we're talking about?
Well, I think there still are petrochemical jobs because until we make a full transition into alternative energy vehicles or make full transitions into alternative sources of energy, there will still be a demand for petrochemical and petrochemical products. So, yes, there are petrochemical jobs, but we want to make sure that whatever we invest in with the relationship to jobs, that they're good green jobs and that those jobs and opportunities are both environmentally and people-friendly.
You get the last word on this, Leslie, and it has to be very brief. Do you expect this to happen really quickly?
I expect to see the stimulus package to start making a dent very soon, because the president was very adamant about saying he wanted to have projects that were ready to go. So there are some such projects and by different states and municipalities. So we hopefully will see some of those so-called shovel-ready projects starting to go online very soon.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you all. That was David Roberts, staff writer for environmental news website grist.org. He joined us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Leslie Fields is the National Environmental Justice and Community Partnerships Director for the Sierra Club, joining us from Washington, D.C. And Jerome Ringo is the president of the Apollo Lions Alliance. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Necessity is the mother of invention, and this was certainly the case when it came to the creation of Strike TV. The web-based channel was developed during the long writer's strike that started in 2007. It is the brainchild of writer Peter Higuchi, who joins me now. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks, Tony.
How did Strike TV come about exactly?
Well, it did come out of the strike, the writer's strike of last year, but More appropriately, it came out of technology and something that really changed everything last year, which was HD technology dropping in price from $50,000 to $100,000 to about $2,000, $3,000.
But somebody must have sat around a table or a couch or someplace and said, you know, this is what we should do. Is that you?
Yeah. Well, I was striking in front of Disney, and I came up with this idea of why don't we just do it? And so we did. Let's just make a website for the Writers Guild, and let's just create shows that we want to, and let's just make it.
Were these show ideas that were stockpiled either in your mind, or you had put together as treatments, and you just hadn't pursued, you know, pushing them towards the networks, and you said, here's an outlet for these ideas, and let's do it there?
Well, I mean, some of them are ideas that have been around for a while, and some of them are brand new ideas. We have 100 series. We have over 700 individual webisodes, and they were all created, you know, just recently.
How do you come up with the rules, Peter, for what should go? You know, on television, mm-hmm. I don't have to tell you, there are rules about format. There's rules about content. There's rules about advertiser support, all sorts of things. How do you determine what rules, if any, there should be for Strike TV?
We don't have any rules other than no pornography, whatever that means, and no, you know, ultraviolence, whatever that means.
How do they make any money? How do you guys make money this
way?
Well,
there's a number of ways. I mean, we do something called hyper syndication, which means that Strike TV content is distributed all over the internet on many different platforms, including Hulu. So there's a Hulu channel on Strike TV channel on Hulu. There's also a Strike TV channel on YouTube and many other websites. It's available on mobile phones and all kinds of things. So each one of these outlets has an ad sales team. They put an advertisement against it. It's called a CPM, cost per thousand. Just like when you watch on Hulu, there's a little ad before. Well, Strike TV has the same thing. It's a little ad. It's like a 15-second ad. Sit through it, and it pays for the bills. It basically, and we do a rev share split on all of these different platforms. So every place that Strike TV content is all over the net, we're splitting revenue with the filmmakers and with that distributor.
One of the things about Strike TV that is of interest, I think, to our listeners is this, that it appears that it would be an opportunity for artists of color, black writers and others, to get in the mix in a way that traditional Hollywood does not seem as welcoming.
Absolutely. And that's what's really exciting for me, not just black writers, but Asian writers and Hispanic writers. Disabled writers. Each of these groups in the Writers Guild has a caucus where they are, you know, get together and try to figure out how to, you know, empower themselves. And, you know, Strike TV's doors are open for these people. I mean, for all people.
Is network television, cable television, willing to, maybe willing is the wrong word, to abide by Strike TV being in there with them? Are you an issue for them at all? Are they supportive of you? Do they see you as a I don't know, farm system for getting new shows onto the network ultimately?
Ultimately, we're an ally for them. They're not willing to spend a lot of money taking huge risks these days, both movies and in television. Everything's based on a book or something that we've seen before. And so this allows Strike TV, basically allows them to see what hits. You know, we have a show that really takes off, they can pluck it up without ever having to spend millions of dollars in development costs. And there's a built-in audience there. So they see us as an ally, and we see them as an ally. You know, we are able to test something. Maybe there's something that's really weird that they'd never greenlight, but the audience is waiting for it, and they would love to see it, you know. And you know, for very little cost, we're able to go out there. And the other thing is that Strike TV is not editing anything. It doesn't tell them what to do. They own their copyright. This is the first time ever, 100 years, that all of these writers have been able to maintain their copyright and creative control. It's never happened.
A win-win.
It is a win-win.
That was Peter Hiyoguchi. He is the founder and CEO of Strike TV, a web-based TV network. He joined me at our NPR West studios. So what's it like for the actors, writers, and other executives who work on Strike TV? I spoke with their vice president of brand and ad sales, Terrence Coles, along with writer Rod Email, but started by asking actress Ellen Sandweiss, who stars in Dangerous Women on the network, about the types of shows that are available on Strike TV.
the great thing about Strike TV is the variety, and we're actually striving for more of that. I'm on the new submissions committee as well, so we're reviewing new shows. There's everything from comedy, animation, sci-fi, drama.
There's a talk show.
Talk show.
There's kids programming.
Sketch comedy.
Live. We did a live webcast event this past Saturday with a person, Jeffrey Berman, from The Right Environment, where he interviewed writers. So we interviewed Robert Hewitt Wolf from Andromeda and other fame. And
you know, the beauty of it also is that the range is just huge. The range of actors, the range of... But the one thing is that it's all professionals. And again, like Terrence said, it differentiates it from a YouTube or just somebody with a camera putting something up. My project in particular came about, it's called Dangerous Women. And it came about because I was in a cult film called The Evil Dead in the 80s, and the three of us actresses have gotten together. And the writer of our show, David O'Malley, had wanted to write a film about us, but when he heard about the writer's strike, he decided to turn it into a web series. So this was the perfect vehicle.
That was going to be my next question, actually, and I want to direct it to you, Terrence. And to be blunt about it, is this material any good?
You know, what drew me to strike, and one thing I should preface this by, currently, all the executives, everybody working for strike, is not being compensated. We're currently looking to raise money. We are really running this company based on passion, based on what we believe in. So to answer your question, I walked in, I saw 40 to 50 different shows with multiple episodes that were all quality, shot well, written by people with sensitivities like Rod or people like Ellen and other folks who we know that are major writers. So Stephen D'Souza, who wrote 48 Hours and Tomb Raider, he's on Strike TV with Unknown Sender. Lester Lewis is on the board of Strike TV and writes currently for The Office for NBC. So we are around the talent that makes everything you see in traditional television, but we're all sort of banding together in order to open up creativity based on the distribution that is now available and the production that's now available, sort of leapfrogging the traditional system, to be honest with you, using digital distribution in the online environment.
That's really interesting. I want to ask you, Rod, as a creator of a show, I would imagine that you would want to maybe pursue a dual track with a new program. In other words, if you can get it into Strike TV, great. But at the same time, if you can get one of the networks to buy it, that would be even greater because of the money.
That would. But going through Strike TV makes it good because the creative handcuffs are off and you have created the show that you wanted to create. And if a network wants your show, that's because people are coming to it. People are watching that show. And the worst thing you want to do is change that show that you see on the internet than when it gets to network.
I would think that given the climate in network television fare right now, mm-hmm. that a show called Black Guys Talking wouldn't have much of a chance.
Not really. It wouldn't have.
It wouldn't, would it?
It wouldn't have a snowball's chance in.
Yeah, right, in that place. So what is this show about? Well, I guess it's about Black guys talking.
That's basically what it is. It came from
kind of like what we're doing right now.
Black guys talking.
This is an episode.
Yeah. Black guys and a white woman talking.
Yeah.
How's that?
I mean, you know, initially it came out when I was on the show, I always, you know, I'm usually, no pun intended, kind of was the minority in the room. So, you know, I always noticed that a lot of sitcoms with black people always had these amazing jump off points, you know, like the children were orphaned tragically, or, you know, the young man from Philadelphia had to run across the country away because of some bully, you know. But I always saw white shows and it was just white guys talking. And I know that I'm a black guy, and I know other black guys, and we're just always black guys talking. I think we're pretty funny too, and it just
your eyes are not getting big or anything during the that bubble eye stuff.
No, that's just it. It's like I talk about normal things, you know. I I don't, you know, the whole chicken and wine and the other stereotypes. No, I mean, I like Karen Carpenter. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I mean, you know, it doesn't make me a bad guy. You know, I like Karen Carpenter.
Yeah, you have to give up your hip-hop card if you like Karen Carpenter, I'm afraid. Let me come back to you, Terrence, to ask you about the making of the money. Clearly, you started this as a way to create a creative outlet.
Yes.
But I'm assuming that at the end of the pipeline, you were hoping that this could turn into a profitable venture.
Absolutely.
So where are you now with regard to that? Because part of your title says that you are the ad executives as well. So you have ads?
Yes. So we run ads. We're currently doing a campaign with Zappos.com. So if you go on Strike TV, you'll see a pre-roll ad from Zappos.com. That's a campaign we're currently running. We sell integrations within the shows. So my real job is working with all of the content creators to find ways to weave a brand into some of these shows such that the brand goes wherever the content goes. And then at Strike, our job is to distribute things as far and wide as possible, cutting deals where we get a piece of the revenue everywhere we distribute. And of course, on our own network, we get all of the ad revenue and we share better. We get the best deal in Hollywood in terms of what we do of our content creators. They get the majority revenue share. So, and there's not a network in town that would do that.
So I see Ellen's hand went up. So do you get any money that's really, you know, money? Are we talking about?
Not yet, because this is still such a new venture. You know, everybody has spent so much of their own money making this network work, right from the creators. Everybody who worked on my show was volunteer, as is everybody who works for the Strike TV network. So yes, we're just building all that up, but it's really growing.
Yeah, I think what's unique is we are building the model, but rather than putting – so I've worked and raised money. I worked at a company called Entertainer, the first video on demand network, 1998 to 2002. I was SVP of programming there. I paid a lot for content. Today, my content comes from creators who have paid for the content, and we all now work cooperatively to build a business model that will then support us and the content provider moving forward, and that's where we are. We're currently raising money for Strike based on building the business model of us cooperating with our content providers and building out the distribution network in order to facilitate that.
Let's talk about the programming again for a moment. The show that I saw, I think it was called Lawyers, the episode that I saw, I should say, was it looked to be maybe 3 or 4 or 5 minutes long. The content that you have, the range in time goes from a few minutes to feature length?
Currently, the longest thing we have is probably about 11 to 14 minutes, so we are definitely short form. But I think to the point you were asking, Rod, what we see as Strike is we would love nothing more than for a network to pick up one of our shows. We see ourselves as the ability to change the pilot system. They're making less pilots in Hollywood today. We're taking all of this creative energy and funneling on the internet and allowing it to be seen and viewed and allowing people to build an audience. And as it builds an audience, we'd like to see that progress.
Well, what do you think about the name, Rod?
Yes.
I'm sorry about that. Strike TV seems to conjure up a couple of images. One, a knockoff of Spike TV, which I'm not accusing you of. And secondly, you know, it reminds people of the strike. And are those good things?
I think it is a good thing because it reminds us where we came from. That strike was a hard decision for a lot of people. I can tell you, I was one of the beginnings. Like, I really didn't want to strike. You know, it was hard. It's hard to find work as is, and now we're gonna go on strike. You know, that was a big decision for everybody. But I come from a union family. My parents are teachers. I've suffered through strikes, but I think it's a good connotation. Some people may see it as a negative thing,
but it also, the word strike has so many different meanings,
yes,
right?
It does.
And so if you look at the Strike TV logo, it's like a
lightning bolt.
So you know, and it goes when it comes on and. That's how I see it.
Okay. It is. Yeah. It's strike while they're going to strike with this opportunity. Yes, it has the double entendre of the writer strike to remind people. And this was definitely an outgrowth of writers who said, look, why are we striking? You know, Peter tells the story of sitting on the strike line and talking to all these great creators from Lost and other people. And they said, well, why are we here? And well, why don't we just take some shows and put it out here? And if we're fighting for these rights that we need residuals on the internet and the rest, why don't we define our own destiny by putting our own content out there and understanding what the revenue is so we understand what we want a piece of?
All right. Let me ask you this as we bring this interesting Strike TV conversation to a close. I feel like I'm in a Strike TV boardroom with the executives and people like that. What's your favorite Strike TV show, Rod?
Hold, please.
Is that the name of it, or are you asking me to hold on?
No.
That's the name of the show.
No, that's the name of the show. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. That is the name of the show. That is the name of the show.
That's funny. Ellen, what's your favorite?
Well, what do you think?
Of course.
Dangerous Women.
Well, I was throwing a softball to you there. Dangerous Women. Rod, what's the most popular, if there's a way of knowing?
So far, the most popular has been House Poor by Lester Lewis with Mindy Kaling from The Office. That show has done very well. There's only one episode as a pilot there, so it's done well. For me, there's shows like Faux Baby, which have done 6 episodes.
Now,
and
Faux
really
Baby, now you're on a black show, so Faux Baby can be F-O-Baby. F-E-A-U-X Baby.
It would be the F-A-U-X Baby.
Okay.
and it plays off the whole concept of that.
You have to recognize where you are. I appreciate all of you coming in. It's been a great conversation. Good luck with Strike
TV. Thank you very much.
That was Terrence Coles. He is Vice President of Brand and Ad Sales at Strike TV. We also heard from Rod Email. He is currently developing a show called Black Guys Talking for the channel, and actress Ellen Sandweiss, who stars in Dangerous Women on Strike TV. They all joined us right here at our studios of NPR West.